Chapter 12, the last chapter, It's Never Too Late. In the Middle Ages, Europeans dreamed of a utopia called Cockaigne. Said to exist on a distant isle, Cockaigne was a place where unlimited food appeared whenever anyone wished for it. Roast meats, grilled fish, stuffed goose, and fruit pies could be had in any quantity simply by thinking of them. Rivers flowed with wine. No matter how often drained, cups magically refilled themselves with beer. Some buildings were even made of food. You could sleep as long as you wanted, days on end if you wished. You could have sex with whomever would agree, as often as you wanted, without pregnancy or any legal complications. Everyone wore clothes made from fine fabrics in bright colors. In the Middle Ages, fine clothing being what the typical person most longed to possess. Everyone's pockets bulged with gold. Most of all, no one had to work, for no work needed to be performed. Food grew itself, plates washed themselves, fires tended themselves. Small wonder that men and women in an age of poverty, drudgery, food shortages, and condemnation of sex dreamed of a realm of drinking, eating, sleeping, free love, and never being called to toil. Musicians of the Middle Ages sang songs of Cockaigne. Mothers hushed children to sleep with tales of how they would someday be transported to this land. Many must have reflected, bitterly, on how merciless was fate to allow men and women to imagine such a kingdom, but never experience it. Historical asterisk? With the exception of exemption from labor and a few details like washing the dishes, hundreds of millions of Americans, Europeans, Canadians, Japanese, and Australians today reside in Cockaigne. Others have dreamed of different utopias. In his 1516 book that gave the concept its name, Thomas More thought utopia would be a tranquil and modest place. Money would not exist because people would gladly perform fairly pleasant tasks to produce whatever society required, then exchange generously with others. Flashy clothes would not exist. More detested competition over who could afford the rarest fabrics or brightest dyes, and essentially wanted everyone in a school uniform. Unhappiness would not exist. People would lose interest in possessions and status, and in doing so, be set free from the cycle of desire. Thomas More wrote Utopia as a satire of money-obsessed, fashion-obsessed, gotta-have-it-now 16th-century England, and was surprised when readers told him this imaginary land sounded like a place they'd like to live. Needless to say, hardly anyone, except the deeply philosophical or devoutly religious, today dwells in the Utopia envisioned by More. While all the materialistic obsessions about which More fretted still continue, at perhaps 100,000 times the global GDP. Still others have imagined Cloud Nine differently. To the Greek thinker Plato, the essence of a perfect society was political. Small communities of well-educated landholders happily would submit to rule by philosophical guardians who would own nothing themselves, in order to exercise wisdom divorced from self-interest. Plato would have been horrified at the idea of a CEO setting his own pay number. To the Roman poet Virgil, humanity should long for a place called Arcadia, a romanticized countryside without violence or disease, in which people lived simple lives, laboring relatively little because crops never failed, and where every day life consisted mainly of appreciating nature, music, and poetry. Arcadians would work and farm in the morning, have long naps after a big lunch, spend evenings singing, dancing, and drinking huge quantities of wine. The next morning they would rise at dawn, never with an aching head, to speak a humble prayer of thanks as they beheld the daily miracle of the arriving sun. There would be no princes or rich men, and, as important, no one would wish to be a prince or a rich man. To Rousseau and the many he inspired, Utopia would be the abandonment of governments, businesses, churches, and schools for return to a conjectured minimal condition that is naturally good. Everything once actually was Eden, Rousseau believed, until civilization invented the concept of corruption. Nothing could be more gentle than the initial noble savage condition of humankind, Rousseau famously asserted. He lived before the archaeological evidence showing that misery, violence, and general warfare were common, if not standard, aspects of the primal human past. The inventory of proposed utopias would in itself be a book, with everything from anarchy to absolute social control having been proposed in many flavors. Dystopias, reverse utopias where everything is awful, have come closer to realization. In the past century alone, the Nazis, Soviet communists, Chinese communists, Cambodian communists, and Imperial Japanese created dystopias, though all fell. One aspect of dystopias that seems especially frightful is how desperately hard the Nazis, communists, and Imperial Japanese worked to make their societies as awful as possible. In each case, it was not some outside circumstance, a famine, say, or an enemy attack, that imposed sorrow. Rather, the men and women of the society itself, mostly the men, of course, worked assiduously, even at personal sacrifice, to make their nations awful places to live, and to ensure that their friends, neighbors, and own children would be utterly miserable. What this dynamic tells us about human nature, we would, perhaps, rather not know. Yet a dystopia need not be a tyranny. Following the tradition of Thomas More, in 1931, the British writer Aldous Huxley used a depiction of a 25th century society to satirize the society of the present. What he imagined was a perfectly voluntary dystopia. His work, Brave New World, foresaw a place where people were so totally obsessed with getting and having that they would submit to social programming, especially by swallowing drugs that erased their personalities. Freed of human individuality, society functions efficiently. Physical luxuries are everywhere, while no one ever suffers any material need. The anti-personality drugs cause people to smile and appear happy. A weirdly affable Big Brother organization wants everyone to have a good time. Recreation, amusement, and pretty much unlimited sex are available. Men or women who seem even slightly sad are immediately contacted and offered a wide range of delights. But the whole utopia only works because people have stopped thinking. Huxley feared that the quest for contentment, rather than military or dictatorial power, would be the ultimate adversary of human freedom. In Brave New World, men and women have voluntarily surrendered their personalities in return for always having whatever they want. Some people would, in fact, take that bargain voluntarily, while no one would ever volunteer to live under tyranny. This is the reason Huxley feared contentment as an ultimate danger. People will always fight tyranny, but they might surrender to materialism of their own free will. Writing the book in the late 1920s, during the first Western consumerism boom, Huxley thought he saw the budding signs of runaway materialism. Now, the global GDP is 100 times what it was then. Asked to outline a utopia today, the typical Western citizen might say, the abolition of poverty, a big house and car for everyone, and no money worries. Eat and drink what you want without gaining weight. Live 150 years. More sex for men, and more romance for women. Television remote controls that find themselves. Global peace and larger airline seats. No one can say what the future may hold. Nuclear war, new dictatorships, horrible errors of genetic engineering, a comet strike, other things that could go badly wrong. But it is not out of the question that someday the suburban utopia sketched in the above paragraph will more or less come to pass, that everyone in the West, perhaps even everyone in every nation, will have access to whatever material things they require without money anxiety, while living very long lives in slender good health with recreation and romance, and in a world finally at peace. The arrow of progress already points in these directions. Though readers of this book will not live to see the semi-utopia sketched above, their children's children might. Remember that today's Western life would seem to our great-grandparents more or less a utopia. Our relatively near descendants may live in societies that would seem utopian to us, though perhaps it could be argued that world peace is more likely than comfortable airline seats. Economic, medical, and technological arrows of progress, at least, point toward ever better lives. If society advances toward what would seem to us utopia, no one should expect this will mean an end to problems. The pattern of history observed so far is that for each problem solved, a new problem arises. It may be that new problems always arise to replace old ones, each generation handing a fresh set of challenges to the next. There is no reason to think this sequence will ever change, barring the arrival on Earth of the divine. A future society that would be utopian by our standards. No rat race for money, no violence, no person knowing material want. Surely would continue to have problems. People could still be satisfied or sad, be talented or typical, be liked or disliked, still fail to make the class play or drop the touchdown pass in the big game, still have trouble finding meaning in life, still, surely, experience a broken heart. Even in a physical utopia, our descendants will continue to have complaints. I don't know what their complaints will be. I am certain they will have them, and keenly felt. And even if what would seem to us utopia is someday achieved, there is no guarantee it will make our descendants happy. Life has gotten dramatically better for almost everyone in the Western world during the past half century, yet people are no happier. Centuries to come may see life better still, and happiness not increased. This is a poignant prospect, but otherwise need not concern us. Absent the arrival of the divine, it is likely there will never be a social order or moment in time, even in a place without want or fear, when human happiness is assured. Happiness must come from within, and money cannot buy it. Whether or not we attain happiness will probably always be unrelated to whether life is getting better. That people will still be complaining in Arcadia should not prevent us from continuing to move one step closer. The world remains a place of want, fear, and injustice. It need not be so. If the last century of human progress teaches anything, it is that it's never too late to change the world. In our lifetimes, impossible problems that could never be solved, pollution, crime, indigent old age, the Cold War, have declined or disappeared before our eyes. Astonishing reforms and progress have been accomplished more rapidly, and in most cases at lower cost, than anyone dared hope. Endlessly, experience teaches that we need not accept what we see out the window. We can make the view one of our choosing. The reason that the problems of the present, such as developing world destitution, greenhouse gases, or poverty amidst American plenty, seem unsolvable today, is simply that we have not yet begun the work of solving them. We should, for it is never too late to change the world. Want can end and be forgotten. An artificial greenhouse effect can be prevented. Even in a world of many billions of souls, there can be a safe and secure place for everyone. It is ours to decide what the future will hold. And if we decide well, the future may hold an ever better life, about which our descendants will complain. This is Jonathan Mayrose. We hope you've enjoyed this production of The Progress Paradox, How Life Gets Better While People Feel Worse, by Greg Easterbrook. To find out more about the complete Books on Tape catalog of unabridged audiobooks, call our customer service department at the number on this package, or visit us online at booksontape.com. The Progress Paradox, How Life Gets Better While People Feel Worse. Copyright 2003 by Greg Easterbrook. Published by arrangement with Random House Audio Publishing Group, a division of Random House Incorporated. Production copyright 2003. Books on Tape Incorporated.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.